All right, so we'll break this up into two parts. One will be primarily a set of quotes from the last many tons of years on why we think we need common sense as common sense for language. And then if we believe then we actually do need common sense, we'll jump into maybe we can get some common sense from language, or maybe not. Okay, so Hobbes wrote, "We use words to talk about the world. Therefore, to understand what words mean, we must have a prior explication of how we view the world." So what do we mean by this knowledge? So to define it, if I know some proposition P, you know some proposition P, I know that you know P, you know that I know P, then we're going to call this shared knowledge. We're not going to infinitely recurse. We'll just leave. We'll just stop at the second level. Okay. So these are things that the two of us know and we consider shared. Background knowledge, then, is if we have some group and we know that everyone within this group knows it, then we're going to say this is background with respect to the group. So if we were to start talking about CKY, maybe about half the people in this room would know what I'm talking about. And so this is going to be background, relevant background for an NLP person. And when we get that group big enough, some larger social group, then we start talking about this as common knowledge or common sense. So Nunberg referred to this as the collective sense. And so skipping through some of this, we see another reflection of the importance of it, where the collective sense does play a role in the interpretation of all utterances, even when I'm ignorant of it. And there's been a number of talks this week that's sort of been pointing at this idea that when we're doing various language processing tasks, we may not be able to explicitly conjure up the sort of propositional content that we would need to understand these the utterances, but we all seem to agree that there is something sort of there latently. In the 70s, Ellen Prince referred to this as stereotypical tacit assumptions, where she tried manually enumerating some of what these might be. So she assumed that if she were to bump into someone in a subway, she could take for granted that the person she was talking to would know that people have parents, they may have siblings, they may have a spouse, a home, a television, a clock, neighbors, and so on, and that countries have various properties, and that this is all just part of this sort of collective sense, or again, stereotypical tacit assumption. This goes beyond just basic propositional content. It's the same general idea in the Minsky notion of frames, which has been talked about already this week, and most people know it. And what people might not connect it as easily, but Schenck was developing the same idea sort of roughly in parallel. So Minsky came up with this idea, and Schenck said, oh, actually, I was thinking along the same lines. So the initial script paper points directly to the Minsky frame. And for those that don't know, frame is sort of overloaded in our community. So the Fillmore notion of frames, so in terms of frame net parsing, is related to the Minsky notion of frames, but these weren't initially the same thing. They're related concepts. So a Minskyan frame is basically a larger structure over a larger situation or event of the things we would expect to obtain. And then Schenck wanted to extend this idea to various things that are going to go forward in time, where the canonical example is, if I say I ate dinner at a restaurant and I stop talking, you immediately conjure up a number of events that probably occurred. Like there was probably a waiter who served me food, I paid a bill, and so on. Earlier, Dan referred to this term by Clark, and then was repeated by Percy, where we start to get into this the issue of inference. So I have this background knowledge, and I need to be able to quickly be able to pull this up to be able to derive various conclusions on the fly. So Clark referred thought of this as a particular form of implicature, of these bridging inferences. So as a simple example, and I think this was repeated earlier in the week, John walked up to a house, he knocked on the door, what door? So this is exactly the sort of thing we're trying to resolve. We have no problem realizing that it's the door of the house, but how did we actually know it? And we can talk about these sort of general statements stored structurally in our heads, which most people nowadays would disagree with. But generally, if there is some X where X is a house, there's probably some Y where there's a door and X has Y. And then a very long, cumbersome gloss of that, which the succinct version is just that houses have doors. And everyone knows this. So we agree that houses have doors, and then how might we represent this, either through some logical form as above, or how would we represent this probabilistically, which was more the point of the prelim workshop this week. And again, another point about inference, going all the way back to McCarthy. Shank reflecting the same general idea. And so then Hobbes, I threw this in because I don't know how many people have actually read Hobbes nowadays, but this idea of being able to do quick inference sort of on the fly, where I'm trying to prove Hobbes views text understanding generally is as utterances are being sort of unrolled, as I see each sentence, the act of interpreting this is trying to prove each new sentence, to try to have the minimal proof to go back through all the statements that I've seen that justifies why someone said this. So this is the famous interpretation as abduction idea. And this, I throw this in because this is my favorite example of John heard steps behind him. He began to run. Why? And in this term, implicit question answering, I think then sort of brings this to the way a lot of people currently, like the work of Percy and others on trying to find some tractable set of problems in language understanding. They're going into natural language interfaces, to databases, as these explicit QA setups. And we can think about a lot of general language understanding as this sort of perpetually running forward inference implicit question answering process. Okay, so if we think we need common sense, then maybe we should try to define, like, can we actually recognize it? Like, if I give you a sentence. And so the easiest way is I say, is P common sense? Is this particular statement common sense? So I can just state it, and then if we think it's common sense, then it's common sense. And this is naively what we think we'd be able to do. And then I say, okay, a person may have a therapist. This is gonna be common sense. Now you can easily imagine putting this statement on Mechanical Turk and asking people on a scale of 1 to 5, is this common sense? And it's not going to be all fives, right? People are going to have a ranging opinion on, like, how common sense is this really? And then we start debating for the rest of the evening on what common sense is. So in my thesis, I played with this test that Kai had used, who adapted it from much earlier from Benny Shannon, which is this test for presuppositional content. And it's called the hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that P test, HWMP, where the idea is, originally this was come up with just a test whether or not something was presuppositional. So if I say, I had to take my sister to the airport, you reply, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that you have a sister. And this is well-formed, right? And so but I cannot say, or you can't say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that you have to take your sister to the airport. This test, under this test, you're not allowed to challenge the primary assertion of the utterance. You're only allowed to test for presuppositional content. Okay, so this sort of isolates these presuppositions out of the general sentence. So a test for common sense, then, is embed the statement that you care about as a presupposition, not the primary utterance, and then run the HWMP test. And if it's well-formed, but it sounds silly, then it's probably common sense. So for example, I left my dog at the pet therapist on my way to work. It's totally reasonable for you to reply, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that a pet can have a therapist. If you say, I left my sister at her therapist on my way to work, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that your sister had a therapist. So this is also legitimate. So neither, the first item is not common sense. The second item is also not common sense. This third one is, I left my sister at her therapist on the way to work. And if you say, hey, wait a minute, I didn't know that a person can have a therapist, now this seems funny. So if earlier I stated that the original test was a person can have a therapist, and in that, at least, I feel that's going to be a little tricky to try to get direct classifications on whether or not that really is commonsensical. But this sentence seems silly. Like, it seems silly for someone to utter this. I have stronger feelings about this than otherwise. This general lack of knowledge of common sense inference is often repeated as one of the main things that killed strong AI in the 80s into the early 90s, where we generally sort of moved over to more small task-oriented problems, focusing on incremental improvements. But then people started to complain, even as that was happening, where you have these famous statements like this, where, to read it all out, we might define progress very carefully as displacement towards the ultimate goal. And so this would be this sort of task-oriented, iterative movement that the community has been moving for quite a number of years. But But again, the first person, the first man to climb a tree is going to make tangible progress. And so there's a number of variants of this expression where of various forms of tree climbing, where I climb to the top of my particular tree, I hit its limit, and so now I'm making big progress. If I climb down that tree, I find a new tree that goes another couple feet higher. So I use the new statistical method that allows me to get one more point, but I'm not really closing that 50-point gap. Snarky bitter people that had all their grants shut down in the 80s say, so you're just tree climbing, you're just tree climbing. And so in the other direction, then you say, well, okay, I want to build this system that really has a really big notion of common sense, and I want to bring back old school AI. There have been attempts at that. Starting around the mid-2000s, people said, maybe we should try bringing some of this back. I don't want to keep doing tree climbing. And then you have quotes like this, which I like quite a bit, where we say, well, okay, I took this system that was supposed to be really fancy, that had this really expressive power, that could make use of all sorts of great stuff, but it didn't do anything. I ran it, this is on an RTE task, that it couldn't answer any of the questions. A lot of these systems are such that unless it completely understands what it's reading, then nothing happens. And the whole point of these statistical systems is they tend to be more robust, where they can sort of make this little bit of incremental, guessy sort of games. So then you get these rocket ships with nothing inside. And so then just in the last year, Johan Bose says this again, where it seems generally that if we want to move forward, knowledge acquisition still seems to be one of the major problems facing what we're trying to do. Okay, so we need all this knowledge, and prelim was about we want to have some probabilistic model of how we're going to represent everything. But something we didn't talk about so much, it was not the main focus of the workshop, but is this big sort of critical question of even if we have a representation that's smooth, it's more data-driven and robust than what we had in the 80s and 90s, this doesn't answer the question of where we get that knowledge in the first place. We still have, the fact that we use modern machine learning techniques doesn't actually tell us how to solve the knowledge acquisition bottleneck. We just have different ways of using the knowledge if we had the knowledge to begin with. So one way we could build up that KB is since we now have the hey, wait a minute, P test, we can go ahead and manually generate a whole lot of stuff in bulk. And so Hobbs thought about that in the early 90s, and there was a little tech report that sort of sketched out ideas on this. Psych is the most famous example of paying professionals to try to do this. Project Halo, which is eventually led to AI2, the company that Oren was representing earlier in the week, did this as well, and that it was recently shut down, the sort of more professional knowledge-driven setup. There's been crowdsourced attempts at doing this, where you just ask people to put in knowledge, and this predates Mechanical Turk. A lot of people in our field aren't so aware of that line. It's a good stuff to go look at. And then Louis von Ahn and his general Gamify the World did do a project on trying to do this for knowledge. But I'm not gonna talk about the human setup. We could talk about that over drinks. I'm just going to focus more on what if we wanted to try to do it entirely from language. Okay, so we're not gonna allow people in this process for the rest of the talk. We're only gonna talk about getting it from corpora. Well, one of the main pushers of the human-backed setup in the intro to one of their papers says, well, the reason why we need to get this from humans is because we're never gonna be able to get it from text. All right, like Grice says, it's not going to happen. People are not going to give me the sort of information that I need out of text. Thus, I need people to do it for me. More colloquially, Oren says, the knowledge we need ain't there. Nick says, why can't we get this from the web? And he says, well, it's not there. It's just not there. So just for those needing a bit of refresher, the relevant bits of the relevant maxims from Grice that people keep pointing at are this notion of quantity and manner, where in more info theory terms is language is about, most people would agree about maximizing the available bandwidth. Just as a couple cartoons, if we allow the length of this string to be manner, and quantity I'm going to have on the y-axis, then we want short things that have a lot of information content. So if I tell you Obama visited Paris, that's a fact. That's something that tells you something new about the world. And if I say that countries throughout the world have capital cities, well, you probably already knew that, and why am I talking about it in the first place? This is just wasting all of your time, okay? I'm gonna talk about two approaches on how we might extract knowledge from text. First being generalize from assertions about individuals, more like direct statements about things that happened in the world, and then we'll jump into interpreting generic sentences. So this is one of the, I think, the better quotes of this general notion that we have all of these sort of normal texts out there, and it seems like just underneath the surface, if we could only just do a little bit of text processing, we could start strip mining this for a lot of world knowledge. So the general notion of knowledge acquisition, which is, I think, distinct from the sort of the line that Oren has pushed on machine reading, although there may be some post hoc trying to, like, conflating all these things together. Machine reading originally was really much more about trying to extract facts, like factoids of this Obama visited Paris. We want to know everything about the world, about the individuals that actually are in the world and the various properties that they have. I want to build Freebase. That's machine reading is about building Freebase. Knowledge acquisition, generally people mean that to be these more commonsensical things where I might not know who any president is today, but I do know that countries have presidents. This is just something that seems to be a rule about the world. So the pipeline is we need to sort of recognize a bunch of basic predications in the text. We need to abstract from those predications up to entities and from these entities up to their semantic classes or their linguistic kinds, where step two is basically the main thing that doesn't occur in a machine reading sort of system. You're just going to sort of stop at step one. So one, two, then count, do something. That's going to be your secret sauce for whatever your system wants to do. And the result is going to be various rules or probabilities, something that we think might be useful for downstream inference in some NLU task. So when I say recognize patterns of situation descriptions, you can pick whatever your favorite term is. There's lots of different systems that do all these things. My students know that I jump up and down a lot to say that basically everything on this list is pretty isomorphic, especially if you're trying to do a sort of basic tuple extraction task. Each thing is better at some things than others. Some are faster, some are more robust, some have a slightly deeper level of representation. But for the purposes of the rest of this talk, we're going to say detect basic predications and the arguments. Run over a large collection of documents. So there's here's just a few of quite a large number of examples. There are two columns because some people publish under the title knowledge and other people publish under the title language, more language modeling. That I might care about verb-verb co-occurrences because this is a selectional preference task, like the verbs and the nouns that they appear with. So what sort of things for, if I want to do a better parser, then I care about selectional preferences. But if I care about knowledge, then I care about sortal restrictions. And there's an entirely different set of terms that people might use. But in terms of the tools and our capabilities that we have today, this all ends up being really the same thing. So for example, the next system by Schubert that I ended up banging on a bit during my thesis has this example of we have some sentence, we put it through a Penn tree bank style parser, a lot like the Stanford dependencies would also in the background gets this sort of parse. And then we derive these various propositional contents, these very pseudo-logical forms that all can be converted back into English through a process. So this is something that existed quite a while ago. Take some text, rip it into a bunch of little basic propositions. You can do various things with them, and then you can gloss them back into natural language to see if the system is doing very well. So again, note here, we don't see Glendora entered the room. It's a person entered the room. We're abstracting up to the fact that we think Riley or Glendora are each people. So I'm disappointed that Oren didn't make it. Because if we recall, Oren said, I went everywhere. I looked at Nell and I looked at my own stuff and there was no examples of this sort of knowledge. And this was part of the response to Nick when he said, there's just nothing out there that can actually do this. He said, well, that's not really quite true. So as he was talking, I go to the project website and I ask just apples and edible, which is an example that Oren gave. And we see that, yes, indeed, an apple can be edible. Flesh may pertain to an apple. There's various things about apples and skin. Skin may pertain to an apple, so on and so forth, and various other properties about apples. So this isn't very hard. Like the difference between what this system is doing versus a machine reading, OpenIE, whatever sort of system is really just the difference of you both have to extract basic predications and then add a gazetteer, do some class abstraction, and that's what gets you these sort of knowledge. Another way you could go, in brief, but this is mostly to just talk about how awesome search engine query logs are. I spent a couple summers at Google with Marius, where if we zoom into query logs, the idea is that there's a lot of knowledge about the world that we can get out of the questions people ask. And so the Google and Microsoft and so on, they sit on top of this just total goldmine for general language understanding. Unfortunately, it's very useful for them to keep hold of it. But if we could get access to it, that would be great. That's why I went back to Google to do a second round of research there. There's just a ton of this natural language, common sense-y sort of stuff you can do with grep. Grep and Perl gets you fair ways. Where if you just say, like, what is the X of Y? Put it into search engine query logs, and you just have billions and billions and billions of queries, and you say, oh, look, people are writing, what is the capital of Texas? What is the capital of New York? What is the capital of Florida? And if I can determine that everything in blue is part of the same conceptual class, now I learn that in general it seems, because people keep asking these questions about the different individuals, that states seem to have capitals. Going back, because people, I think, forget that this is in there. The original Church and Hanks paper, where it's most cited for introducing PMI to the community, or this mathematical description of a psycholinguistic association score, it had at the end the same sort of games people played for decades on looking at correlations between syntactic outputs. They had a parser at Bell Labs. It was not nearly so robust or data-driven as what we have now, but they could parse to some extent. And so this game of piping data through some sort of system that's going to give you a structural output, pipe enough data through it, and then look for statistical correlations has been around all the way back to arguably one of the first papers on this general idea of doing data mining for lexical semantics. The VerbOcean effort, which was sort of this Hurst idea of enumerating a bunch of patterns on how verbs might correlate, are going to give you correlations like this. So this sort of predates the later Chambers and Jurafsky style of work, which exploited coref chains to be able to do similar sorts of abstractions. Little self-tuning is the paraphrased database, where we want to be able to find that various things mean the same thing, and you do that by pivoting over bilingual corpora and say that if I have something in English that maps to something in German, that same something in German maps to something else in English, then you can say maybe these two things in English mean the same thing. You do this, you add in a bunch of monolingual distributional statistics to clean it up, and it works out pretty well. You get lots of really nice paraphrases, and this can be downloaded at paraphrase.org. You can all write it down, it's really nice. Okay. So I said we can do this predicate extraction. That's basically what all these tools do. Now we need to add in some other sort of thing that says, okay, I recognized Kansas, or I recognized Sally, I recognized the name of some baseball player. I need to be able to abstract from that individual up to the appropriate semantic class. And there's various things that we could call this. There's been many systems to try to automatically induce these ontologies, gazetteers, class lists, et cetera. One of the best known ones is this work by Ryan Snow at NIPS with Jurafsky and Ng. This figure is one of my favorite figures in computational linguistics because Marty Hurst had a very famous paper in the early 90s where she wrote down a very small number of rules by hand to say, if I want to know that X is a Y, so a beagle is a dog, then if I just grep for X is a Y, then maybe I'll find things like beagle is a dog. Maybe people just say this normally in text. And she publishes this paper. It's all very nice. It was one of the first along these lines. Ryan went in and said, if I just give a bunch of examples like beagle dog and look for all the different ways that we might have connecting text between these two items and then dump it into a log linear model, what happens? And what happens is that you get performance above what Marty Hurst got by a fair margin. But what you also see is that the patterns that have the most impact end up being the same patterns that Marty wrote down herself, and that you're getting all the boost by these either very high precision, low recall, or high recall, low precision. But an additional thousands and thousands of patterns that are weighted in just the right way. So this figure for me captures this 21st century contribution to the field, that we already knew how to write X as a Y. And when we apply these more automatic methods, I think what we tend to find is that we learn what we already knew. Like the major impact knowledge just seems to pop out of these systems anyway. We tend not to, as a matter of science, we tend not to discover the big things by applying these techniques to text. What all these methods are doing is sort of filling in along the edges all this much more mushy things that sometimes apply, and it's giving us that extra robustness that we seem to need. Okay, so the challenges then of trying to learn knowledge, this common sense knowledge from text, I think is roughly these three, where this is kind of sort of solved. We can definitely do this in bulk, and we have a lot of basic patterns. you can download from various websites. There's this work on trying to go beyond like a single sentence, so that requires us being able to handle coref a lot better. Automatic coref kind of works, and so there's been some work in the last few years. The Chambers and Jurevsky work is sort of the most canonical example of trying to have multi-sentence patterns. This has, I think, a fair way to go before it's going to give us more of the scripty frame stuff that we want. But at least we're actively trying to make this work. But this is the big issue. So we have these sort of possibilistic statements, but now we have this problem that I refer to as reporting bias, where what we've been able to do thus far is we can extract a lot of predicate argument patterns from text, and we can count them. So we have statistics, but these statistics are with respect to the text. So if we're talking about language modeling, we're all set. Like, I can predict the next New York Times article better and better by collecting these statistics. But that doesn't mean that I'm actually learning statistics that correlate with things that are true in the real world. And the example that I tend to repeat a lot is this blinking and breathing, the B&B case, where if we just simply look up the frequencies of various verbs out of the Google n-grams, so these are just all these words that appeared on the web, we find that breathed and blinked are much less frequent than laughed, which is in the same order of magnitude as murdered. This is simple, and you can say, well, maybe if you filter this way and you do this and you do that. And I have done some of those studies that are a little bit more complicated and I don't want to get into, but this is the basic issue, that we all know intuitively that we tend to selectively describe the world. There's both, we don't uniformly at random pick some space-time interval in the world and start talking about it. We talk about sort of the most exciting events. And then when I talk about that exciting event, I also don't uniformly at random give you propositional content about that event. I'm describing the most important things that aren't common sense. And because of these two facts, even if, say, the New York Times was just a listing of facts, which it's definitely not, there's all sorts of narrative devices that are in there anyway, which are going to confuse your system. But even if it was just a straight listing of facts, it's only telling you things that we think could happen. But the frequencies are wildly, wildly off. And there's a separate issue of whether or not we're even trying to have a model of the real world versus a model about how people think about the world. And I have a lot to say about that, but that's for an evening conversation. Okay, so if we're hitting a stumbling block on method one, then we can jump over to method two, and we'll just say, well, you know, there is Wikipedia, right? So maybe we can just directly interpret these generic sentences, because it seems like these sentences are just telling us flat out that there are various things that are true about the world. So when I say generic, what do we mean? What's a generic sentence? Well, Krifka will tell you this is a generic. All right, and I'm not going to bother to explain that at the moment. Instead, you can sort of read this, but the basic idea, jumping to the end, is that generics are sentences that have this nomic, or this, basically this rule-like property, that I'm telling you things that seem to obtain about the world. Okay, these aren't universally quantified, and they're definitely not universally qualified in many cases, but they're sort of expressing the general properties just directly. I'm just telling you, often in some sort of circumstances, these sort of things seem to apply. So going back to Krifka et al., and we see the very simple generic dogs bark, then we're going to say there's some implicit in this case, generic quantifier, some generalized quantifier. That could mean some, all, many, most, at least a few, et cetera, et cetera. So, because when I tell you dogs bark, I'm not telling you how frequent this is. Like, all you have is these two tokens. Right? You don't know what the quantifier is that's implicit. The restrictor is going to be the predicate dogs, and the matrix, in this case, will be bark. So what's implicit is not only do we not know what the strength of the underlying quantifier is, we don't even know what we're quantifying over. So one interpretation of dogs bark is that if I take all the individual instances of dogs in the world, some of them might have the property of bark. Okay, there could be at least one event such that dog barks. So we could have mute dogs and we could have non-mute dogs. But I could also mean that I could be quantifying over events where there are some instances where a dog barks. So this could mean that there's just like some single dog that barks quite often. Going back to the previous example, it's not clear here whether I mean that this dog barks all the time. So if I say that these five dogs of the 10 dogs in the world, these five dogs bark. Okay, so does that mean that they bark continuously, or does that mean they each barked once in their life? The sentence doesn't tell you that. And then there's this other interpretation that we could be talking about kinds. So I could be quantifying over everything that satisfies this sort of dog kind predicate, where it could be that beagles, anything that's a beagle can bark, but anything that's a poodle doesn't. And this is something that comes up and people that study generics worry about it. So going from this, what we'd really like is to go to this. Right? You just say, well, this is all just a matter of conditional probability, that we're conditioning on some set, but we don't know what that set is, and something holds, although we don't really know what holds, and that probability is something, but we don't know what the probability is. So, okay, we just interpret generic sentences. I interpreted dog's bark to be this expression. All we need to do is just fill in, you know, what each of those three things are, and we're good to go. Wikipedia does not have hyperlinks to dog, bark, and gen to values. So it's not there. You just have the natural language expression. So as I said, there's these two general approaches, one for abstracting situation descriptions, one which basically gets us to the point where we can automatically generate a generic sentence, or we could directly interpret a generic sentence, which allows us for basically deriving, again, generic sentences. So the point of this slide is method one, I think, just gets us to the same point that we start with method two. In both cases, we just simply have to transform generic sentences into real-world probabilities. That's tough, and just as another couple examples, these are canonical in the literature. Ducks lay eggs and sea turtles live long lives. We can't even say that, well, at least it's most. Like, no, you wouldn't have even have written it if it's most or all. So it's maybe not universally quantified, but maybe we can just say all generics are between 70 to 100% true. That's not true, since less than 50% of ducks lay eggs, none of the male ones do. And sea turtles live long lives. Generally, people consider this to be a true statement, but most sea turtles actually die very young. Most of them, they hatch out of their eggs, they make a race to the ocean, and then seagulls and stuff come and eat them. So very few sea turtles live longer than a day. But the ones that do live longer than a day tend to then live quite a very long time. So the quantifier there then is going to be a very small probability. But people seem to accept the sentence. So the summary then on the knowledge acquisition side is, it seems like we definitely can do this extraction. We definitely can make these general statements. We can get these generics if we want to go the knowledge acquisition route, the factoid generalization route. But the real issue is determining this proper quantifier strength and what the actual domain restrictor is. If we actually want to make forward progress in understanding, if we want to acquire common sense knowledge from text, these are the two issues. And so since that time, I've continued to do a little bit of work along those lines, but I've mostly said, well, I need to have a better understanding on how to process very large amounts of data, which then leads to an entire different line, which I'm not talking about today, on big, giant data processing. So when Jason says that it may be hard to summarize sort of what I've been up to in the last few years, a lot of it is motivated by this same issue from 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. It's just that it's a very subtle, complicated problem, and so it requires a lot of work in a couple of different areas, which I can talk about more later if anyone cares about. So that's it. Thanks.
Breathing examples. I wonder if there might be other indications in text that things occur so frequently that they're not ordinarily worth commenting on. I bet if you look in text, "she didn't even blink" shows up more or something than at least more frequently than you would expect, mm-hmm. given how often "she blinked" shows up.
Yeah.
"She didn't sleep" or "she slept badly" show up often. And in general, either negations or modifications. Like, the only reason we would mention this is to describe why it didn't happen or why it happened in a different way than usual.
Yep.
And that really seems like a clue that you don't usually comment on it, right?
Yep. There definitely are clues, just like... So when Jason and I were discussing this a little earlier, he said, well, in generics, like for blinking and breathing, couldn't you imagine finding a sentence of "humans blink on average this many times in any given day?" And I said, yeah, you definitely are going to find that. There's a lot of things you're not going to find directly stated in generics, but some of this you will be able to get. Just like in this case, yes, that's going to be a very useful signal. So Jonathan Gordon, doing some follow-up work along these lines, sort of started teasing out some of that based on some earlier work. that we looked at. So an example that we used, that I used, was something along the lines of Sally really liked Billy, but she didn't ask him out. Implies, like you can infer from that, that often if a woman likes a man, they might ask him out. If a person likes a person, they might seek to do that. And you can, and so that just means, okay, so now I've gotten maybe above the 50% mark. Maybe. I don't even know if that's true. So you can get signal that starts to narrow what the strength is, but it's still very far away from getting anything very strong.
So I was just trying to understand your position a little bit better. I mean, towards the end, you were somehow saying that, you know, we can actually, using Hurst patterns or fancier versions, extract all these rules, and the main point is how do you actually put, you know, soften them and figure out the right quantifier scope and scale up?
Is that not fair? Scope, or so strength and the
strength
domain.
And the restrictor.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if there's...
And no, it's not a matter of scaling up. It's just a matter of... I mean, we can definitely process the web. I mean, we can parse the web. We can generalize from that and get an army of possibilistic statements.
So I'm wondering if there's still structural things which are kind of missing. And maybe you're folding those into here where, you know, how are you going to... I mean, you know, I think of common sense as not, you know, just a set of facts, but a kind of an entire rich system and of how the world works, and especially when you go into kind of the more spatial domains where there's a lot of non-linguistic structure.
Right. So I think if we were to keep talking about that, then you're going to quickly run into that's going to be the same argument as whether or not you need grounded language in general, whether or not we're talking about common sense or anything else. And I tend to believe that we're not going to be able to get all of our knowledge out of text. And so spatial things, I think we are going to have something that's a lot more embodied. But your point about basic propositions versus a more, if I interpret you correctly, versus a more complex set of inference rules in order to get something moving, I'm sort of considering that as part of the whole puzzle. So when we have things like, actually, quite a lot of slides ahead. I mean, things like PPDB can be pushed forward to give you basically template-to-template matching of the sort that David has been talking about, to be able to have ability to do forward inference. And then more things along these lines of where this isn't just a man may ask out a woman. This is more like if a man asks out a woman, they might go to a restaurant. So the ability to be able to push some system forward, I think we can get. It's just that if you were to do straight textual inference, if you were to do inference on the knowledge that you acquire from text, what you're going to do, again, is predict the second half of the document. So if I give you the first five sentences of a document, you're going to be able to predict the sixth sentence with lower and lower perplexity. I think I said this to you already, but before this talk, but if you were to ask that system, was Sally blinking? Like the expression Sally blinked, if I added that as sentence number six, that's going to have wild entropy because it just never occurs in text. Like it's just something that isn't going to be there.
Right. Let me try to clarify the question. So it seems like what you've shown is statements which are a form, you know, generics. You know, do we have the restrictor and then the matrix, and maybe you can get some inference rules. I mean, do you think this is kind of sufficient, or are there other types of structures more relating to, I guess, frames or...
So what I meant earlier about the relationship between frames, scripts, and anything else is that frames are just larger objects. They're larger generics. I mean, I can express in a single sentence, like I could take Shank's script and remove all the periods and just said, if you go to a restaurant, you might sit down, you might order a meal, you might, and then this happens, and this happens, and this happens. And if you took a step back and looked at that structurally, that's going to be one massive, complicated, single generic sentence. So when I say generic, I just mean swap generic for just these general, everything commonsensical is what generics are meant to express. It just happens that all the canonical examples of generics are just these single sentences. But the basic notion of I need to quantify over some sort of set of situations where I don't know what that set is, and I don't know what the subset is of that set, such that some property obtains afterwards. And that could that just generalizes across, I think, any of the problems we're talking about.
What do you do with cases where you have both general pre-theoretical common sense beliefs and scientific beliefs but all coexisting in common ground and being incompatible? So, for example, common sense view of tomato is as a vegetable. Uh-huh. But most people are aware of the fact that, or many people are aware of the fact that tomatoes are actually fruit. Or more interestingly, mm-hmm. common sense notions of space and time and relativistic notions of space and time.
So that's great. So that is what I meant. Maybe I'll find it here. So in red, so this last point about asking me about psycholinguistics offline is we've been doing some experiments for quite a while. We finally published a couple that are looking at this line of work where we know that, say, reading times of individual words correlate with lexical frequencies, or picture naming or whatever, and these things sort of propagate all the way up to the level of syntactic, and there's a little bit of information, there's a little bit of signal for semantic, and I think that if we really were to probe that more, and this is something we're taking a look at, of trying to get reading times that seem to, where the underlying where one of the underlying factors should be, like how commonsensical are the correlations between these events, it's going to be very interesting to see whether or not text-based frequencies correlate with those human performance measures, and especially if you were to probe this for cases that there seems to be in text reflected a certain fact that's false with respect to the real world, that where there is some portion of the population that knows X about tomatoes and the other set knows something else about tomatoes. And you find that people generally react with respect to how the text is reported. What this generally would mean is that our model of what we're trying to do in the first place may be misguided. Well, I don't think a lot of people actually explicitly state what they're trying to do in the first place is anyway. But it could. A lot of people, I think, implicitly assume that we're trying to learn all this knowledge as it relates to the world, and that's going to help us do better natural language understanding, and this is all the same thing. But it might be what we're actually trying to do is come up with a model of what people have in their heads, and that we could have this robot that doesn't actually know like how dangerous it is to ride a motorcycle, but it does know that people talk about motorcycle accidents all the time, and so it's afraid to ride a motorcycle just as irrationally as a human is, or rationally, actually, because motorcycles are pretty a lot more dangerous than is reported on in newspapers. So.
I want to go back to your notion of an implicit question. A man heard steps, he ran, why? So, coherence in text, there are going to be many things that are inferred by the reader that are not stated. Mm-hmm. We have possibilistic generics. You can mine possibilistic generics. Mm-hmm. So my question is, I understand that, well, the first observation is if you could count statistics of things that are not said but are inferred by readers, if it was annotated somehow that way, you would be much more accurate in your probabilities.
I agree.
So, but it's not annotated that way.
Right.
And the inference problem or the bootstrap, it's going to be very hard to recover that stuff. It's not that the inference problem of inferring the unstated consequences is difficult. Mm-hmm. Do you think that so there are two aspects of that difficulty. One might be that it's information theoretically not there. There's not enough data. The other might be that the inference problem is just too hard. Do you think that the information might be there?
Some of it. I think some of it is not. I mean, I think in the end, language is designed to communicate between people, and we all just assume we have this background knowledge. So the entire point of language is to try to put just the highest entropy statements back and forth between us. And so there's not, like, going into this, there's no reason why we should have assumed that we could acquire basically everything everybody knows by looking at text. I mean, language, this is basically what Havasi's point was in the first place, that there's just a lot of stuff that we know we just shouldn't be talking about very frequently with any real frequency.
We've got a lot of text.
We have a lot of text, and there's various games we can play. So in the last prelim session, it was suggested that one could look at, say, very simple questions posed to fourth graders in multiple choice exams and ask, and removing the multiple choice out of it and asking Turkers to write down everything you think you need to know in order to answer that question. And you could play games on exactly how you pose that problem. And if you could actually make that work, where there seemed to be some sort of commonsensical statements there, then you might be able to say, okay, well, if this is a statement I need to know, then what are the statistics in text that correlate with this particular statement? And you might be able to sort of bootstrap some amount of signal out of text to start calibrating this. But in the end, I think fundamentally, even before getting into the issue of like spatial knowledge and whether or not you need grounded stuff, I just think that we're not going to get it directly out of text. It's not how we learn about the world, and we invented language, so it seems unlikely, or at least, yes, it seems unlikely. My money is not on being able to learn everything about the world from text. Is that a question, or does your wrist hurt? Okay. Okay, no question.
Okay, well, let's take that again.